The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Well, here we are wrapping up 2020, and considering everything that's gone on this year in our world, I can honestly say that the best thing about 2020 has probably been this show. And of course, I'm kidding, sort of. But anyway, we're going to be back next week with some new episodes, new guests. I want this year's New Year's episode to take a moment to look back at some of the important interviews the show has done in 2020. And of course, the developments at AE 9/11 Truth that those interviews were covering. So I've picked out four of them, and I'm going to be playing segments of them for you this evening. We're going to start with an interview I did with AE 9/11 Truth board member Roland Engel and Dr. Leroy Halsey of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This was from back in the spring when the final version of the World Trade Center 7 study was released. Let's listen. It just seems to me that so much work has been done in this report and in all the work previous on World Trade Center 7. I mean, now that this report is out, what else can be done to make the case? I think I asked Richard Gage one time this on the show, and what I want to hear from you guys as the engineers here, starting with Roland, I mean, is there anything further that can be done on World Trade Center 7 to point to the fact that we're not getting the full story of what happened that day?
That's a very good question. I think the information is clear now. I'm satisfied that the information that we have produced, including this report, over the last 15 years, proves without a doubt that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition. That information is oftentimes presented to the public, most often as some kind of a conspiracy theory. However, we're progressing from an engineering standpoint of, in this case, constructing a virtual model, subjecting it to the fires, looking at the observed collapse, and coming to a reasoned scientific conclusion about what caused that collapse. So we've got to take that information now out to the universities. We're going to encourage the universities to study both reports. They have students that are routinely assigned to solve forensic problems that are presented to them in this field. And we're going to ask that the universities take up such studies. And they can come down only in three ways. They can say that the NIST report is valid and they stand behind it. They can say that the University of Alaska study is valid and they stand behind it. Or they might come up with some third hypothesis as some theory as to why the building came down. But I think it's very important that this discussion take place in the engineering community, that the public be aware that this discussion is going on, that the public encourage the engineering community in every way possible to take up this study, and that people continue to assist us by funding us to go out to the engineering community. So far, we've made 22 presentations to chapters of professional organizations like the American Society of Civil Engineers, the National Society of Professional Engineers, and various universities. We've gone to conferences, and we're getting a great response and a lot of interest. And that all takes money. So money is a very important aspect of this, and we have only been able to accomplish this with the support of our many supporters who have contributed the money that has been necessary for us to pay for this study and to pay for our efforts with due diligence and our other efforts to publicize this issue. And so there's a role to be played. We're a grassroots organization. We're a nonprofit. We don't get any money from any special interest. We're not endorsing any products. We are simply in it for the benefit of the reputation of the engineering community and the responsibility that we have to the general public. So everybody has a role to play. Wherever they fit into that model, they should play their part. We encourage everyone to take this up as a matter of great, overwhelming importance to our society.
Dr. Halsey, in our last few minutes here, I want your thoughts. Is there anything that can be further done to raise alarms about the story we've been given by the government on what happened to World Trade Center 7, scientifically speaking, I mean?
Well, it sure would be nice to be able to open up the original design drawings. I'm talking about the design calcs, the design drawings, the contracting construction companies that were involved in the company in that in the building of the building, all the materials and their how they were inspected and reported through the shop drawings as well as through the inspection reports when it was being built. There would be a really wonderful experience to be able to take pieces of the material that were brought down and see if we could actually have a metallurgical evaluation of them. Even small samples would give an indication of what and the details of what that microstructure might look like. First time ever that I've seen a failure come down where the concrete was powder instead of broken chunks with some respect to the steel. It would be nice to, although we can never accomplish this task, but because it doesn't exist any longer, but it would have been nice to be able to look in the microstructure photographically of what that dust looked like and what it was made of.
Okay, this next interview is from September 10th. Each year I try to make the 9/11 anniversary episode special, so I was joined by Drew DePalma, who lost his mother Jean at the World Trade Center on that fateful day, along with Jean's sister Michelle Cabiasco. In this segment, they talk about their experience on 9/11 as they learned of the event and the loss that they experienced from it. Here it is. Yeah, I like to also consider the show, other than being just a forum for activists, but an oral history of things related to September 11th. So last time Drew was on the show, we heard his story, his 9/11 story of that morning. I'd like to hear it from your perspective, Michelle. What was your experience that day? How did you learn the news of what was happening and what proceeded for you afterwards?
Well, I worked at that time in a law firm which was literally across the river from the World Trade Centers. So as the events were unfolding, we could see everything happening from these large picture windows in our law firm. And so naturally, somebody obviously got a phone call or somebody turned on the TVs or whatever people's computers were on, and things were coming through about the World Trade Center. And obviously, everybody ran to these picture windows and we watched. We could see the smoke and the fire and all of what was unfolding. And then, of course, like all of us, we all picked up the phone to try to call my sister. But naturally, because we didn't have any idea of what was really happening at that time, it was a fairly new job she was working. She was on, I believe, the 99th or 100th floor, something like that. And that is exactly the wheelhouse of where the planes came in. So my sister instantaneously was gone, unbeknown to us, because some of us weren't even aware what floor she was actually on in the World Trade Center, because it was kind of a new job for her. So that was also kind of a scramble to figure that out as well. And so naturally, when we were making these phone calls to her cell phone to the office, obviously towers were knocked down. We were getting no response at all. So we were literally in the dark for most of the day, not knowing, you know, or hearing any contact from her. And then after we had found out, I was working in the law firm in Newark, and all transportation was halted. You could not get a train, you could not get a bus, you could not get a ferry into New York City, which is where I was living at the time, uptown. And so I got a ride back to my parents' house in Wayne, New Jersey, And, you know, naturally, like everyone, we were all riveted to the TV that night. And the next day, my brothers and I, we took the PATH train into downtown New York City to see if my sister was on any of the hospital lists. And we were downtown. It was, I think it was St. Vincent's Hospital. And, you know, we were standing online waiting. And my brother Stephen turned around and looked back. And he said, I can't even believe that there's this huge gaping hole in the sky like that. I can't even believe that those towers are no longer there. And as we proceeded on this line, we then checked the database of the hospital, and they said no, that my sister had not been brought in that evening or the day before. And so they directed us to go to a police precinct to fill out a missing persons report. And as we were on that line, I overheard two gentlemen whose brothers were working at Cantor Fitzgerald, which was the floor on top of Marsh McLennan, talk about how they had received phone calls from their siblings stating how hot the fire was and that they were trying to get to the roof but could not get to the roof because it was locked. And once we realized what floor my sister was on, it was really at that moment that I really realized she was gone. And we proceeded to fill out our missing persons report. I had just seen her a couple days before because she and I had spent a whole weekend in New York City. So I knew her nail polish color. I knew what kind of jewelry she had on her if she was found. And, you know, like everybody's family, you know, nothing was recovered of hers, body parts or otherwise, because she was literally in the wheelhouse of the explosion. And that was pretty much how my first day or two went during the events of 9/11. And New York City was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I felt like I was in like a war-torn country. People were just stunned and holding up pictures of their loved ones and just like in a daze. Have you seen this person? 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 It was really very surreal. It was kind of like I was in some kind of fog that was sort of swirling all around me. And a sensation that I've never really quite felt before in my life.
Now, when Bob McElvain was on the show, I had asked him this question. I'm going to ask this of Drew. Obviously, there's shock, there's grief, and I can't imagine what it's like, too, because usually when a tragedy happens in normal circumstances to a family, it's a very private thing, but this was a worldwide spectacle that everybody was watching and following, and I don't know how that impacts the situation for all these grieving family members in the days that follow September 11th, but I'm curious. I know that I was angry, just as a spectator from Florida, and ready to seek revenge on whoever they put in front of us on TV said did this. Was there anger for you, Drew, following the loss of your mother?
I mean, absolutely. You know, it's not every day that your mother gets murdered by some international terrorist. You know, it's like Michelle was saying, it's just such a surreal feeling that no one in the world has probably ever felt before. You know, I'm not really a military man myself, but, you know, there's always the thought like, I'm gonna go pick up a gun and join the military and go get revenge. But, you know, that's definitely not something she would have wanted. She, you know, I kind of took a different approach, kind of just living your best life. You know, life is short. You know, Jean lived it to the fullest. I'm sure she would want me and my sister to do the same, not, you know, spend the rest of my days in a foreign country seeking out something that, you know, the war itself was, you know, weren't even necessarily attacking the right people. So, you know, what am I getting revenge on? I did have a bunch of friends that went into the military and, you know, told me, you know, how they did their part. So I'm super proud of them and all the other military forces that took part. You know, I wasn't much of an activist before I met Ted and AE 9/11 Truth. But once I met him and tried to, you know, seek out the truth a little more. I tried to do my part on the, you know, the other side, you know, just getting the truth out there is, you know, instead of, you know, taking revenge on whoever it happened to, because to this day, I'm really not, it's not super clear, you know, the who, what, where, and why. So it's kind of hard to point the correct finger at the correct person.
Now, as you may know, earlier this year, AE 911 Truth filed a request for correction to NIST regarding its quote-unquote official World Trade Center 7 report. It was denied, and then AE 911 Truth filed an appeal, which is still pending. Ted Walter led this effort, and he appeared on the show with 9/11 family member Matt Campbell to talk about it. I'm going to play for you a portion of that interview in which Ted discusses this important action. All right, so I've already hinted at what we're here to discuss today, but Ted, I'm going to have you lay it out for our audience. Talk about the request for correction to remind our audience what that was all about, and then the appeal.
Sure. So earlier this week on Monday, we, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, along with 10 family members, including Matt, and 88 architects and structural engineers, filed an appeal to NIST's initial decision on the request for correction that we submitted back in April of this year. So the request for correction is a document that essentially uses the Data Quality Act to basically question or request corrections to information that agencies, federal agencies, have disseminated. So the NIST final report on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 obviously falls into that category as information that the agency has disseminated. And in the request for correction, we point out eight areas in particular, and there's many more, but eight areas in particular where NIST has committed information quality violations under the Data Quality Act, which means that they've failed to comply with their information quality standards, which require the information that they disseminate to be objective, unbiased, completely, you know, fully stated, and so on. Some of these areas, you know, people that have been following this issue for a long time will be familiar with. There's the steel that was recovered from Building 7 that was severely eroded, that underwent sulfidation and intergranular melting, that was documented by the FEMA investigation back in 2002. That's one of several issues that we raise in the request. The ultimate goal is to have NIST revise their report on Building 7 to correct all these violations. And in order to truly do that, they would actually have to throw out their theory on the collapse of the building and come up with a new theory that is physically possible and that fits with the evidence. And we know that theory is straightforward. It's controlled demolition. Most people who watch the building come down can tell intuitively that the building was demolished because it comes down symmetrically into its own footprint. And if you measure the rate of collapse, it's coming down in free fall, and so on. NIST had 120 days in which to respond to the request. Ended up responding a little bit late, about 2 weeks later than the deadline, and that was in late August. And, you know, we obviously were not shocked to, you know, find out that NIST rejected our request for correction. Unfortunately, I have to say I was taken a little bit by surprise at how simplistic and you know, unserious and unsubstantive NIST's response was. We submitted a document that was over 100 pages. Their letter is about 10 pages, but not even all the pages are, you know, comprise an entire page. Some of the pages are only half a page responding to each overall point that we made in the request. And so they deny on each of the 8 points that we raised in the request. They denied our request. In most cases, they actually completely avoid addressing the issues that are raised in the request. And in the few instances where they try to go toe-to-toe with us and actually answer our challenges, they really embarrass themselves. They, you know, the the arguments that they make are absolutely ridiculous, which is why, in general, they avoided responding substantively to most of the claims and most of the requests. So from that initial decision that was issued in late August, we had 30 days in which to file an appeal with somebody higher up in the agency. He's basically the number two person at NIST. He's the associate director for laboratory programs. His name is James Olthoff. He will basically be reviewing the appeal that we filed earlier this week. He's supposed to respond within 60 days. Although the language is very flimsy, it says that the associate director will usually respond within 60 days. So it could take longer than that. But essentially what we've done in this appeal, the appeal document is almost as long as the request. It's about 98 pages or 96 pages. And it methodically demonstrates how NIST either didn't respond to the points that were made in the request, which they're required to do according to their information quality guidelines and the Data Quality Act. They either didn't respond or they were just completely their responses were completely irrational. And so we lay that out in detail in the document. And so that's the gist of it. We basically, in order to safeguard against sort of a similar outcome where he sends us a letter that is, you know, two pages or that is totally unsubstantive, we're very explicit in the appeal document about the options that he has, you know, either to accept the requested changes that we're insisting on, or other things that he must do to comply with the Information Quality Act. We also, in our initial request, asked NIST that if you disagree with the changes that we're requesting, well, then you need to make these other changes to at least add some supporting information into the final report, which currently is not in the final report. They completely ignored all of those kinds of requests. And so we're saying, if you continue to disagree with us, you at least have to amend your report to include all of this additional information. And so that's sort of the second option. The third option that we give him in each of these cases is you have to write us a very thorough response that is explaining why all of these arguments are incorrect. And if you don't even do that, then you're not complying with the Data Quality Act and NIST Information Quality Guidelines. So that's the essence of the appeal.
Right. And they can't do that, of course, because they're in bunker mentality. I like this. I like that we are putting them on the hot seat and that we show that we know what we are talking about by requesting this appeal in the way that you just described. Now, I just want to clarify something for our audience, and I was sort of surprised to learn this when I was reading the article the other day about this appeal, but this James Olthoff, the appeal decision is going to rest squarely on him?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's entirely his decision. Now, we don't know what kind of, staff he has or assistants he has who might assist him. We don't know who else he might work with on, you know, responding to the appeal. It does say in the Information Quality Guidelines, and this is a requirement under the Data Quality Act, NIST didn't just add it to their own guidelines, that nobody who was involved in preparing the response to the initial request can be involved in responding to the appeal. So that's important. It's supposed to be a completely independent review of the request of the appeal.
Finally, you may have heard that AE 911 Truth has a documentary out. It's named Seven and is directed by filmmaker Dylan Avery of Loose Change fame. Only a few weeks ago, I had him and AE 911 Truth's COO, Kelly David, on the show to discuss their work on it. Here's a portion of that. All right, so we're all about Seven this week because this film is coming out. Always picking up new listeners, Dylan, so we want to catch them up as quickly as possible. Please remind our audience what Seven is all about.
Seven is a documentary that exclusively focuses on Dr. Leroy Halsey. He's an engineering professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He just recently had wrapped up his four-year study on the collapse of Building 7 and his findings within. And so AE wanted to have a little documentary to go along with the study, so we filmed it last December. spent all year working on it, and now a year later, it's finally coming out.
And that study is such a huge deal. We've talked about it for a number of years, all of the hard work that went into it from Dr. Leroy Halsey's team, and of course, the funding of our supporters, and to try to have this important study come out, which completely refutes what NIST said, as if we didn't know already, but this just puts the final nail in the coffin. And so what do you do when you have a study like this and you got a hostile corporate media and a hostile government that just wants to bury this issue and pile a bunch of other issues on top of the public and keep them distracted? You got to publicize it. What better way to do it than with a film like this? And I've seen clips of Seven already, and I'm going to tell everybody this is going to look very different than a lot of other 9/11 truth documentaries that you've seen. Just a very high quality. Kelly, and you sort of helped out a little bit during the production of this film. You want to talk about that experience?
Sure. I was there for all of the interviews, and we flew to Alaska together with the crew to get the interview with Dr. Leroy Halsey and also to get some shots of Alaska for the film. And our director of photography, Ryan Patrick O'Hara, is fantastic, and we also got some amazing drone shots. Thank you, Dylan, for those. And I think it just adds something different to what we're typically used to with 9/11 documentaries. And the style of this is much more cinematic, much more artistic than what you typically would see, where it's just more informational rather than focusing a lot on the style. So I think that will go a long way in helping to make this documentary better. But yeah, it was great to be there for all the interviews, and we had a great time doing it. And we have a fantastic crew. And yeah, I can't believe it's exactly a year ago to the day that the film came out, where we were actually shooting interviews on that day. So yeah, it's exciting.
You're talking about the cinematic aspect of this film, and that is so important. You know, we've gone from a movement that relied largely on ordinary people, just as I'm an ordinary person. I mean, I didn't make full-length documentaries, but I might make a YouTube video here and there back in the day to just illustrate my point. Very low production quality. I think white-on-black title screens and then just the clip. And that was it. And that was the large part of the 9/11 truth movement for a very long time. That's what we became used to. But most people out there are going to respond to what you see in Hollywood. A lot of that high production value is going to grab more people's attention. I know people are more inclined to watch it. That's what we want to do. We want to break into the mainstream. We want to make 9/11 truth an issue that everybody says that they were agreeing with even before they really were. We want to make it cool. We want to make it something everybody wants to be a part of. I think something like this can blast it even further. Well, that's it. 2020 is in the history books, and now we face a new year as people are waking up to the reality of our world in droves. It's mind-blowing how many more people are now questioning our government and questioning 9/11 itself, too. So we got to seize on that, and we will be in the next year. So I just want to say thank you to you out there for all of your hard work. Let's keep up the fight. Let's bring 9/11 truth to the forefront in 2021. Great things are going to happen this year, and you're going to be the ones that are responsible for it. Good night, and Happy New Year. This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Say, have a great week. Good luck.